We're joined now by Rick Rozoff of StopNATO.org. Are you there?
Yes, I am, Phil. Thanks.
Boy, we are very glad to be talking to you today, and thank you for taking a quick notice. But, you know, I looked at the picture today, and there's a picture, there's a statue of Lenin. I thought that all this happened 20 years ago, but there's a statue of Lenin who was knocked over somewhere in Ukraine, and there are people in the streets who want to put up a statue of a group that was thought to be allied with Germany during World War II. So I thought, this is the kind of thing I better ask Rick about. What is going on there in Ukraine, and does this have some implications from the point of view of NATO and its projects?
Yes, it certainly does. And, you know, lest we fall victim to the standard kind of Western mythopoeia about events of this nature, you know, spontaneous uprising of hundreds of thousands of democratically minded people who are morally...
pro-democracy, I think.
Yeah, you know, and, you know, morally outraged by there being a Lenin statue left in former Soviet space, you know, whatever sort of nonsense we're going to be told. The long and short of it is the precipitant, not the real cause, but the immediate precipitant, the proximate cause of all this occurring is the fact there was a meeting recently of the Eastern Partnership, and I'll try to be as brief as I can on this, but... Mm-hmm. This was an initiative launched 5 years ago in 2008. You know, clearly at the instigation, with the instigation of the United States and its, you know, NATO allies in the European Union in the first place in Europe, but it, you know, the formal sponsors of the Eastern Partnership were Sweden and Poland, who, you know, have some history by launching, you know, Eastern Partnerships of the military variety, you know, 300-400 years ago in Eastern Europe. But what the intent of it is to wean away those former Soviet republics, federal republics, that are not either in Central Asia, for which the European Union has another, as a distinct, you know, alternative plan to integrate them, but to take those six countries outside of Russia, former Soviet republics, not already in NATO and the European Union, those three, of course, are Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, but to move on Belarus, Moldova, Ukraine, and the three southern Caucasus countries, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and to use European Union partnership and ultimately membership as a way of luring them into the West, you know, Euro-Atlantic integration is the standard term. Which
I'm
is
sorry, could I ask you to repeat that? Euro what?
Euro-Atlantic integration.
Okay.
Transatlantic, Euro-Atlantic. But the European community, but the Atlantic community, really. But what we need to realizes the inevitable concomitant of that, of the EU piece, is NATO membership. And in fact, all six of those countries are, I mentioned, the former Soviet republics, are members of the Commonwealth of Independent States, with the exception of Georgia, which withdrew shortly after the five-day war with Russia in 2008. But what that, you know, assuming the EU would have been successful in weaning Ukraine away from not only the Commonwealth of Independent States, but more particularly what used to be called Eurasec, and is now the customs union with Russia, Kazakhstan, and Belarus, it would have represented, you know, bringing all, practically all the former Soviet Union, you know, into the Western camp, into the U.S. camp, ultimately, militarily as well as economically and politically and so forth. So when the government of Viktor Yanukovych in Kiev in Ukraine seemed to demur, you know, ever so slightly at the prospect of being, you know, because he had been told in so many words, and it's not unusual under these circumstances that either he join the custom union with Russia or, you know, move towards the EU, and the choice was his. Well, economically and otherwise, it was much more to Ukraine's advantage to opt for the customs union with Russia, Kazakhstan, Belarus than with the European Union, which is a sinking ship anyhow. I mean, you have people protesting. Young people protesting in EU countries against the EU, and then you have a you know, son of Orange Revolution phenomenon that we're talking about in Ukraine. But you know what we can see is this is not a spontaneous uprising, and it certainly I can't believe that any more than here in the United States, where you could find, you know, people in their 20s who cared much else about, you know, what to put on their iPod, which video game they're going to play tonight, we're really going to take to the streets over something like NAFTA. I mean, not that they shouldn't, but that they would. And to believe for a moment that, you know, masses of Ukrainian youth are pouring into the streets because, you know, European Union affiliation is a matter in their top 10 or top 100, you know, priorities defies imagination. But let's keep in mind a couple of quotes that have been, you know, given the Prime Minister. of Ukraine, Mykolai Azarov, a few days ago said, these are not protests, these they are, and I use his own words, Nazis and criminals. Mm-hmm. Russian President Vladimir Putin said, unlike the word and the chants, you know, some of the Ukrainian protesters, this is not a revolution, this is a push. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had similar statements of that sort, so that, you know, what do we have to keep in mind is I cannot think of any other country in Europe that is geostrategically pivotal, as is Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You know, for a variety of reasons. It's one of the more populous of the former Soviet republics, one of the largest. It has a long border with Russia. It's in the, on the Black Sea as well. It mm-hmm. is a you know, key transit point for Caspian Sea natural gas and oil coming from the Caspian Sea into Europe. You know, depending on how that's worked out, Russia either participates in energy deals in Western Europe or is excluded, which is the intent, of course, mm-hmm. so that, you know, we have to situate what's going on in Ukraine in terms of the geopolitics, and the geopolitics revolves around Eastern Partnership, and also something that is kind of the nucleus of the Eastern Partnership, which is an initiative launched by the United States some 20 years ago that's known by the acronym formed by the first letter of the four countries involved, Georgia, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Moldova, that the U.S. You know, set in place exactly to you know, exclude Russia from the energy market by moving Caspian Sea petrochemicals or petroleum and natural gas you know, through the four countries I've just mentioned into Europe. So that's, you know, mm-hmm. background.
Yeah. Now, this is Rick Razov and StopNATO.org. Something striking has happened that there have been Western politicians, people of some note, members of cabinets and parliament, and whatnot, who've shown up at these demonstrations. You know, if that were to occur in North America, they would be ordered to leave. We had an incident with Charles de Gaulle, as a matter of fact, in Canada, still talks about.
I have to confess, fondly.
And he used a peculiar expression. He said, "Well, vive free Quebec." And they said, "You will leave tonight."
I remember that precisely.
Now, so how serious is this? I mean, they seem to be pretty provocative, like they're looking to provoke something ugly.
Yes, and this is an unusual color revolution scenario in that, or a variation of the scenario in that, there's not a federal election, a presidential election in the first instance this year or now. There will be one, you know, a little more than a year from now, beginning of 2015. And generally, you know, going back to the, you know, the Abovo, you know, prototype in Belgrade and Yugoslavia in 2000. The color revolution started, so-called, about the time of a presidential election. That was replicated, of course, in Georgia in 2003, in Ukraine in 2003, 2004, the following year in Kyrgyzstan and Lebanon. Subsequently, arguably, with success in Moldova, you know, one mm-hmm. of the countries we've been discussing, mm-hmm. With various, you know, attempts from Myanmar and, you know, North Africa for that matter. But, you know, the fact is something is different about this one. Mm-hmm. In that it seems to be precipitate. It seems to be, you know, ahead of the general pattern of what's going on. There has been, you know, talk that with the deployment, I can think of no better word, of Michael McFaul as U.S. ambassador to Russia, you know, beginning of last year, that he's noted to be a, you know, color revolution hand, mm-hmm. An expert, and within 24 hours of his arriving in Moscow, you know, he met with Russian opposition figures and so forth. And again, as you're saying about de Gaulle's statement in Montreal, mm-hmm. that, you know, if the situation were reversed and a new ambassador of Russia to the United States would meet with, you know, the political opposition before he unpacked his suitcase.
Absolutely.
I'm sure he'd be declared persona non grata and just sent out, you know, the next Aeroflot home.
Well, we've had cabinet ministers from Canada participating in these demonstrations.
Yeah, this is such a gross violation in the internal affairs of a sovereign nation, I guess. But, you know, we assume that the West arrogates to itself the right to, you know, defy all international norms mm-hmm. of decency as well as law.
Yeah. Well, again, that is kind of, you use the word, it is precipitous. I notice that the people who manage these things always assume that they won't get their hair singed, but we always want to keep in the back of our minds, They could, and which is why we should pay attention to a site like stopnato.org. And I wanna, there's a second one that we want to know about, which is this odd exchange between China and the United States over Chinese declaration of sovereignty over airspace. Can you tell us where that's coming from?
Yeah, this is, you know, if anything, even more serious, but it gives a, you know, a real good indication of how what high stakes are being played geopolitically anymore. And, you know, we're talking about Ukraine being geostrategically vital, not only in Europe, but really in Eurasia, arguably. And that, you know, China, of course, now, you know, with the Asia-Pacific pivot, so-called, of the United States, we're up to 60 or more percent of U.S. Naval and air capacity is being shifted. Where it's
the famous pivot.
Yeah, the Asia-Pacific pivot is the term the Obama administration has used about. But, you know, the fact that this contest between China and Russia is being exploited by China and Japan in the East China Sea over an island chain, is a comparatively small one that to the Chinese is known as the Diaoyu and to the Japanese is the Senkaku Islands. Mm-hmm. If I may, Phil, I mean, because this is something that many of us attempted to sound the alarm about years ago with precious little success, but I'm looking at an article I had put out in November 4th of 2010, and it was one of a series, you know, where it was painfully obvious even before the initial announcement of the Asia-Pacific pivot that the U.S. was encircling China, much as it is, you know, has been doing with Russia. And I remember one of the articles in the series I actually entitled China-U.S. Relations from War of Words to Words of War. Mm-hmm. Because in fact that was occurring 3 years ago, and you know, I happen to mention this is worth I think going over. Hillary Clinton, being the Secretary of State at the time, had begun a seven-nation tour of the Asia Pacific region a year ago in October. That's, you know, when she 2012 and started at Pearl Harbor, you know, in Hawaii, and then fanned mm-hmm. out when she was there at the Pearl Harbor Hickam base. She was asked if a territorial dispute between Japan and Russia, Japan and China, I don't know why I keep saying Russia, China and Japan over the islands I had mentioned would fall within the purview of Article 5 of the 1960 U.S.-Japan Treaty of Mutual Cooperation and Security, which is a mutual defense clause, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
And her exact quote was that the Senkakus, the Japanese designation for the islands, fall within the scope of Article 5 of the treaty. This is part of the larger commitment that the United States has made to Japan's security and so forth. And she ended up by saying, we consider the Japanese-U.S. alliance one of the most important alliance partnerships we have anywhere in the world, and we are committed to our obligations to protect the Japanese. Now, this is before, you know, China's announcing that it was setting up the air defense arrangement over parts of the East China Sea. So this is, you know, was U.S. policy in advance. They were defending Japan entirely. And according to Clinton, I'm sure there's been nobody to, you know, renounce that since, in the State Department or the White House, the U.S. is committed to militarily intervening on behalf of Japan in the event of a military conflict between that country and China.
When you say that, you know, your person says, and how does that unfold? And unfortunately, I suppose that you'd only find out, you know, when your eardrums have been burst. Is there any international adjudication? I mean, don't these things go to world courts and things? Why is this? Nobody mentions these things.
Well, you know, the San Francisco Treaty, right after World War II, you know, did demand that Japan return all territories conquered, not only in World War II, but I think at least strongly by implication previous to that, say with its invasion of you know, Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And with, you know, from the Russo-Japanese War of 1905 onwards, really, and even earlier, mm-hmm. You know, the U.S. again backed Japan not only vis-a-vis China with the Diaoyu Senkaku Islands, but also, by the way, with against Russia with the Kuril Islands, the South Kuril Islands,
mm-hmm.
where a State Department figure at about the same time 3 years ago that Clinton made the statement, you know, I cited, you know, referred to the South Kuril Islands of Russia as the Northern Territories, which is the Japanese expression for those islands. So mm-hmm. that what we have is the U.S. building up what can only be described, now, the term has been bandied about for a decade or more, an Asian Pacific NATO, an Asian NATO. Mm-hmm. And the same Hillary Clinton, in the same year, 2010, went to a conference of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, in Hanoi, and basically recruited the 12 members of that alliance into a nascent or an evolving military alliance aimed squarely at China, exclusively at China, and fairly nakedly.
It's very striking that you say so many problems seem to be around countries that haven't invaded anyone, don't have foreign bases. China, I think, has maybe one aircraft carrier, maybe two. And I remember when they developed it, the Americans said, we're very suspicious. What do they need with an aircraft carrier? And the question would be, you have a few aircraft carriers, right?
The U.S. has all but one of the world's nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. France has the other one, the Charles de Gaulle, indeed. Yeah. And the U.S. has the only...
So China's guilty of behaving like a sovereign country.
Yeah, heaven forfend. And, there's been a lot of discussion in the quaint terminology of the Pentagon and what's called sometimes A2AD, anti-access aerial denial, is the expression they use. And China's accused of doing that. I think we're safe in translating anti-access aerial denial in protecting one's coast.
Yeah.
And they've even had,
I recall, an overflight where they had to literally knock the American plane down. I mean, they had to rough it up to get it to land. It was a spy plane.
Right. But that's now considered to be an act of war to prevent a foreign and presumably hostile force from the other end of the world parading around the most sophisticated and lethal military hardware in history, mere miles off your shore. If you were to send out a patrol boat or something to monitor it, that's a hostile act.
Resisting assault, we call that.
That's not bad.
I guess, Rick, I have to ask you a last question here. The subject of Mandela has come up. Is any in your writing and watching East Europe and whatnot, is there any comment on the demise of Nelson Mandela?
I have commented on it, and it's a painful topic for me because I'm somebody who I first engaged in anti-apartheid activities in 1975. And, initially, and in general, Southern African solidarity activity. And, of course, Mandela was a hero, for the 27 mm-hmm. years he languished in the dungeon in Robben Island. And, it was somebody I respected tremendously and certainly still do for, what he had sacrificed. However, I don't think anyone during the anti-apartheid struggle thought that South Africa would look the way it does right now after victory. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, to what extent that victory has been severely truncated. Mm-hmm. And if the price of, the late Nelson Mandela's release from prison and some sort of power sharing, at least the formal dismantlement of the apartheid state, mm-hmm. Necessitated such compromises, then it is distressing, to put it mildly. I cannot say that. I hope sincerely that he did not go to his grave as satisfied man.
Yeah. I'm sorry, what was that last phrase? I didn't get
it. I sincerely hope that Mandela himself did not go to his grave a happy man.
Yeah. He visited Toronto, and he said, how do you like this big crowd? And he said, I feel like a hood ornament.
Ah, okay.
I thought, well, that's good Zen there. I think you captured it. Thank you very much. I really share your thoughts on that, and we benefited this discussion Ukraine China. We look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks again to Phil for the opportunity.
Good, thank you. Bye bye. That's Rick Rozoff, and it's stopnato.org, and Rick's writing and his work is. It's something that can keep you healthy and sane if you go to that site on a daily basis. Nobody likes being fooled. And so if you go to stopnato.org, you reduce your chances of being fooled.